You are listening to Vuorotellen podcast by Prologos. Just a heads up, as you can hear, this discussion is held in English. Otherwise, we delve into the familiar matters of communication and social interaction. In this episode, postdoctoral researcher Kaisa Laitinen chats with university lecturer Malkorsata Marke Lahti and senior lecturer Margarete Kriiti Olbert Siitonen from the University of Jyväskylä Department of Language and Communication Studies. Hi listeners, welcome. This is Vuorotellen podcast, and in the studio we have Kaisa, yours truly, and my wonderful guests Marke and Kriiti.
Hi everyone, really nice to be here.
I think it's fair to say that whenever individuals cross paths or communicate in any way, there are always multiple aspects that shape both the way we communicate, but also the framework from which we interpret the meanings created and the information shared in those situations. And aside from individual, situational, and temporal factors, oftentimes the concept of culture is mentioned as something that shapes communication. But this concept of culture seems to be extremely complex, especially when talking about social interaction. So one interesting definition that I actually found goes as follows. Intercultural communication should not only include national cultural differences, but also the relations between communication practices and the social organizations of differences in smaller social groups, such as in the workplace. That definition was by Jacob Loring. So maybe one's mind shouldn't go straight to national culture when the concept of intercultural communication comes up. Marke and Kriiti, you both have thought and researched extensively on various aspects related to this. So let's start with the difficult one. How would you define intercultural communication if somebody on the streets of, for instance, Jyväskylä, would stop you and ask? Marke, could you go first?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and immediately I bump into a problem because intercultural communication is a problematic way maybe of putting it. I would maybe talk about communicating interculturality, and I would see it as a process where people discuss, where people negotiate differences and similarities by drawing on ideas of different group memberships. So I see that you cannot say that, you know, if you have interaction going on between people who speak different first languages or have grown up in different countries, that this will be by default intercultural. It will only be maybe momentarily, sometimes in different ways, about interculturality if people construct such interculturality among themselves as they're interacting. I don't know, Kriiti, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I totally agree, and I would probably answer in a very similar manner, which might be very frustrating to the person asking me on the streets. But I think I would start to explain as well that maybe the term or the concept of intercultural communication is problematic in itself, and it kind of implies that there would be a culture somehow pre-existing communication and determining interaction before we even started. And that is why this kind of terminology like intercultural communication is a bit dangerous, because it might imply, or it might sort of give the impression to people that, well, if I enter an interaction with a person who comes from Nigeria or something like that, then we have intercultural communication, which is why I probably also would start with communication and try to explain to the person that it is actually much more about what you are doing and its communication in the first place. And sometimes there might come up these moments when you draw maybe on culture, when you draw on your experiences and make them maybe even cultural to explain something, to make sense of yourself or something like that. So culture and interculturality is a construct, and intercultural communication does not exist by itself, but it needs people to be sort of to exist as intercultural. Does this make any sense? But
it makes a lot of sense to me.
In a way, I think that people would need to bring up culture in interaction to make communication intercultural. But it never is the starting point. It can be like a moment, like you said, it suddenly comes up, and then it disappears again. Mm. But I don't know how. Approachable that that is, and I can imagine that it is actually quite frustrating for people, because many people have already heard about intercultural communication. It's such a mundane concept even that that people use in everyday life too.
I think that people really like to have those very clear ideas about groups and what they're like, that you know. Now I'm using a lot of quotes here, but that Finnish people are like this, or people from Russia are like that. What we propose is that like, even if people bring some ideas up in interaction and they will say something like, oh, you know, I'm always on time because I'm Finnish. It's just, you know, it's just one construct among many. It has no stable connection whatsoever to what people who can be identified as Finnish, and this is also problematic, what they're really like. I mean, how can we know? I can be waving my arms around like as I'm talking now, and I could say that, look, I'm doing it because I'm Polish. It's part of Polish communication style. Or I could say that, look, I'm doing it because I'm a woman. Or I could say that I'm doing it because I'm enthusiastic about this topic. Any of these constructs is in a way
true. But on the other hand, I also think it is maybe even quite lazy to say that, well, yeah, I'm silent because I'm a Finn. Mm. That's a very lazy way of putting things in a way.
And that even connects to the concept of communication competence. I don't even have to try to be reflective or understand what I'm doing or the reasons I'm doing. I can kind of put it out there that that's because I'm Finnish, or I have this strange cultural context that gives me who I am. And I don't even have to try to develop myself or kind of develop my competencies or develop me as a person, because I can just put it to the shoulders of the weird cultural cape that I can kind of put on.
Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the dangers of intercultural communication or the concept or term culture, that it really sort of might lead people to sort of justify certain things, and these certain things can be actually even quite serious matters.
Yeah.
We don't need to go into detail here, but culture can be used as an excuse, and then we can stop short there, basically.
Yeah,
which is of course quite dangerous and even detrimental to humanity.
and one thing is, of course, when you use culture as this kind of excuse or alibi, this is what Fred Durbin, for instance, writes about. And the other dangerous process is when you use it to other, to construct other participants in the interaction, or then other people as somehow exotic and strange and deficient and worse than you. This may have really serious consequences, and there's like a number of examples of this in research literature. I'm just thinking of Uni Wiken, for instance, who has been writing about, she's an anthropologist, and she's been writing about social work in Norwegian context, and discussing how social workers have been choosing not to step in while observing situations where children, and usually young girls, in families with ethnic minority backgrounds, were, for instance, sent away to their so-called home countries, that of course were not their home countries, and you know, being married off there. the notion comes up that, well, yes, maybe this is their culture. It's okay in their culture to do that. And therefore, we are not going to protect their universal human rights.
Mm-hmm. Why do you guys think we use culture as the scapegoat? We use culture as something that it's easy to kind of pinpoint. Why do people act like they do? Or how can we explain things? Oftentimes in media, you see culture taken as this kind of an easy scapegoat and some kind of a title or framework given to those people. So it's not just this person did that as the title, but it's the person from there who did this because, you know, they're from there.
I think that one reason could be that it is intuitively appealing. It is something that really sort of speaks to us and maybe even to human nature. I think we have this need to categorize things and people. It's very natural. And this way of compartmentalizing the world or the social world is very easy. And then we don't need to think any further. We don't need to find these kind of complex explanations. We don't need to think about the truth maybe that is covered up by the use of culture using the terminology or the term of culture. And of course, it's easy. It's not only intuitively appealing, but it's really easy because it does mean that we don't need to look deeper or dig deeper, and we don't need to think further.
Yeah,
I think it might be something like that, like such a basic psychological explanation.
Yeah.
Plus, it's also entertaining.
Absolutely,
it's like pretty cool. Pretty cool. Now I'm using the quotation marks, but it does have, doesn't it? It has this kind of entertaining aspect to it. And if you think about like the Silent Finn again, if you think about this, how often it is evoked and how often it is brought up in comedy and in all these kind of narratives. That is entertaining, that's interesting, and we can also tell the so-called outsiders about the specificity or the speciality of the Finns, which makes somehow exotic and even more interesting.
You can commercialize it.
Yes.
You can sell a knowledge of this is how you should behave when you're in Finland. This is how you should behave when you're in the United States. This is how you can sell things for these people coming from these cultures.
Yeah, and of course it's not only about selling ideas, but it's about selling products. Mm-hmm. And we can of course see how this notion of national culture is used in branding of different products, branding of different countries.
Nation branding. You just need to go to the airport in Helsinki and see very nice examples of nation branding.
And one other point related to this commercialization is that, of course, since it's so intuitively pleasing and people are so hungry for this, you can see how big a market this is for intercultural communication training and consultation. This might be a very important part of the problem, is that those very simplistic notions of national cultures and how they clash and how you can learn about those other people, you know, and learn the three steps towards negotiating effectively with them
and successfully
and appropriately. Yeah.
Yes.
So all these things sell intercultural communication understood in this very mainstream, uncritical, unreflective manner is a very lucrative activity.
And that is also why I think that any kind of attempt of making changes within this whole system of intercultural communication or the business of intercultural communication is quite doomed in a way, because of course if someone makes money with intercultural communication and intercultural communication trainings, they need this idea that there are national cultures, and they need this idea that we can learn about them and that we can sort of develop a certain competence to interact with people from that culture successfully and appropriately. So
That is very much about kind of building this cultural knowledge, isn't it?
Yes.
Learning about those descriptions.
Yes, exactly.
Roadmaps to cultures. This is what we've discussed so many times, that in a way the message that we put forward, that the way we discuss things with our students and what we encourage them to do, maybe in a way it's not so sexy.
No.
interaction is complicated. Things unfold in unpredictable ways.
And speaking of teaching, when you are teaching, what kind of issues and viewpoints or stances tend to raise most questions in the classroom?
I think that what I have come across is that somehow the term culture or the concept culture causes probably the most problems. And I think I'm not quite sure why this is, but I think it might be because people have been somehow exposed, the students have been exposed to this in school or just in their everyday life, that there is culture, that this is a thing. Maybe there's like this kind of mundane idea as to what culture possibly is. And when I come as a teacher and say that, hey, we have to maybe rethink this whole thing, and we might want to approach maybe culture as something that is interactively achieved.
Culturing.
And that is culturing, and culture being a verb, to use Brian Street, culture being a verb. So we are culturing indeed. So if we sort of try to approach it from the other direction, so to speak, and not as something that is just automatically there, I think it starts it kind of confuses the students, and it also it has an effect on their worldview, or it attacks their worldview in a way. Mm. It might have it might be scary to hear that maybe there is no culture, that it is maybe not a good idea to start with culture, but to rather observe or study or understand that culture comes through interaction. I think it might have somehow an effect on how students view the world, or it might actually even maybe threaten their worldview in a way. And this is something that I have been struggling with as a teacher, or I can see as a teacher that the students are maybe not immediately fine with this idea that, let's just let go of this idea for a moment and approach it from the other direction, to speak.
Yeah, I noticed just the same problem. And it's so much in, those mainstream old-fashioned notions of culture are everywhere, and so they are the discursive resources that we have at our disposal to talk, and it seems that in a way we are trying to teach our students a new language, and they're slowly trying it out, and every now and then they somehow fall back on those old ways because this is like so intuitive and it's always been there. And I think that to many of them it's also liberating when I tell them, look through the window, can you see Finnish culture there? I mean, can you see it? It's just a social construct. It does not exist as some objective fact that would somehow define you or pre-exist our interaction. It's nowhere there. It's only in what you're doing, in interaction. And I think that so many of our students do relate immediately when we discuss concepts such as othering, when we discuss the notion of identities inhabiting spaces between among people, not something that we carry inside us and then just somehow reveal, like exhibition, like flashers to others, but something that we negotiate all the time, and about identities being intersectional. I think I think many students react with such relief when they understand this, that maybe this is a situation when someone has been trying to impose a certain category on you, while you are actually trying to present something else, to identify yourself in a different way in this specific situation, or to understand how many things about yourself and about your trajectory and about the many, many group memberships that you hold important, you know, be it with those real small groups in your life, or then those imagined communities such as nation or language or, I don't know, student community. So how these different things intersect and might become relevant. Or we also talk about language as a social resource, not a conduit for a national culture, but as a resource that we need to express our professionalism and expertise, for instance, or to be included in a group, a way for including, excluding people, all these things, ways of being creative with language. And I think that they kind of connect to all these things. And then every now and then they will
jump back to
national cultures, traditions, dishes, and
yeah, this is very interesting that one has, like, on the one hand, this kind of the kind of situation where students come to you after class, for example, and thank you for a lecture that has been on culture and communication, and sort of open up even on how how they have experienced this and that, and how now they understand that they are not alone, maybe, or that they are not crazy thinking about culture like this, like as a construct. But at the same time, then even throughout those courses, at the same time, national culture still does come up. It seems to be like a very difficult thing to let go of, this idea that it is something that we carry around with us, or that is out there when you open the window. It might be because it is so intuitively appealing, or it is because we have grown up with this and sort of been socialized into seeing the world through categories. And that makes it very difficult to let go.
Yeah. And then, of course, those categories, they are upheld by larger structures. I mean, they're, you know, we are reminded of being a national of a country whenever we travel somewhere.
Yeah, and then, you have to fill in a form or something. Where are you from?
And then this kind of ordering, because of course you can have a better passport and a worse passport.
Yes.
So there is, of course, there's those kind of power relations in this system,
which makes it probably also hard to sort of let go, because this is something that surrounds us in a way that you just need to walk through the city and or you need to just interact with people, and it's just dumped on you in a way.
And it's sometimes it can be very annoying, like even like speaking from a very personal experience, thinking of my own immigrant background, that I don't really like see myself as an immigrant. I see myself as a local person here, but there are those situations when you go to hairdressers or to get a massage, the person there asks, so where are you from? While I understand that many people might think that this is very polite, that this is something that you should notice, that you have a
show interest
that you have this different looking name, or you speak with an interesting accent, or you speak English, so they ask, and then I think I often find it actually extremely annoying, and I avoid such hairdressers.
I mean, it's a difficult question. It really becomes sort of impossible to answer in some cases. And I have been in this situation.
Where are you from?
I don't know anymore how to answer that question. And it's kind of unfair because it immediately means that I'm somehow odd.
Different.
Different. And
Perfect example of interculturality.
There is no easy answer. Yeah. There is no easy answer to this anymore. At least in my case, and I can imagine from this is sort of something that I guess many people experience nowadays, that there is no easy answer, and it also implies in a way that you are not from here, and you don't belong, and this is
you should
explain your accent, you should explain why you make mistakes when speaking English or when speaking Finnish. It's a question that is very polite, like you said, but at the same time it opens up all sorts of problems for people, and I think we should become aware of that. And it really, to me, it means that I can recognize that you are not from here, when in my own mind I'm totally from here. Like this is my home. This is like where I raise my children, and this is where I belong.
And so I think that connects back to the notion of liberation.
Yeah.
So I would like to see the feeling of freedom in being able to create together with other people, mm-hmm. the culture. So like you said, if it's a construct, then I too can be part of creating what that culture is and means, rather than it being given to me as something that it just is and I have to accept
Absolutely.
And act accordingly.
Yeah. The thing is that I think our possibility of offering such discourses, like if we, I don't know, if you maybe think of the larger like kind of societal level, I somehow still see this as so limited because there are those other discourses like this kind of also this kind of celebratory discourse mm-hmm. on about multiculturalism, for instance. Let's celebrate mm-hmm. differences that is somehow at the end of the day so oppressive. It goes against the grain, I think, mm-hmm. of what we're trying to say here. That mm-hmm. instead of allowing people the possibility to define themselves on their own terms, we are kind of told who we are and how excitingly different we are, or how excitingly different groups of people are. And of course, this is what worries me a lot, because this is what you can see a lot in schools, for instance, mm-hmm. whenever there are those kind of multiculturalism initiatives. They're mostly about celebrating the Russians, I don't know, New Year or Indian foods and things like that. I think that a lot of the times it only serves to other children instead of helping them to see where they're actually very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How they could connect to one another.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is, again, it is such a thing that apparently has like these good intentions. To maybe like train awareness, or to make people aware of difference and that there are different ways of handling things or thinking about things. I don't know, but it's exposing people when we have, for example, diversity trainings or diversity weeks or something like that, it might actually be quite detrimental for a child, for example, in terms of being a full-blown member of the group, of that little society, of that little community at school, to be exposed as an outsider who somehow knows about their background, their culture. Again, I'm using quotation marks, who somehow knows and somehow can explain and is like an expert. I think this is highly problematic and unethical, maybe even, because those children want nothing more but be the same and it's
to
I agree yeah to belong to blend
identify
in
themselves
and
with.
Yeah to be a member full-blown member of the group, and they don't want to be different and othered, and yeah, so the intentions are surely very good and just, but there might be maybe other ways to make it work somehow. Yeah, it's a tool of othering, even though I think that hasn't been designed for that purpose, obviously.
Yeah.
So it should be more about similarities, indeed.
And I think that this might also be the cases for adults in the working life.
Yeah, yeah.
It's I don't know, like even thinking of own research and the situations I've like been able to look at, or the talks I've had with research participants. I would say that for most of them, those interculturality moments are, they're only fleeting moments, and they're also very complicated and very different for each and every person involved. But it's mostly about feeling part of the organization, feeling part of the group or team. This is what matters. This is what we want to make relevant in the working
and not
life.
Only being part of the team as an Indian, or being part of the team as a Russian, but being part of the team as a co-worker, as a
professional,
like normal, like everyone else, so to speak. I think this would be actually very important.
We have been starting to embrace this more complex view of, for instance, what does it mean to be in a group? And already in schools, they might start the group project by defining their group's rules or something like that. So they get to kind of create what does it mean that our group is the way our group is. But there's still, for some reason, in terms of culture, this kind of preference of having this simplistic view.
This is a perfect example of small culture formation. Adrian Holliday proposed this concept, and I think it's so handy. I think this is what we have to offer, as you know, to balance this crazy talk about national culture that is an imagined community to us. Mm-hmm. But small cultures, they are the small groups that we actually are part of. You know, people we interact with on a daily basis. This is the kind of the level of culture talk that
we should focus on. Yeah. And this is actually, or maybe that organizations could also focus on, because of course there's oftentimes this kind of teamwork, or teams are merged or torn apart. And what you can see in these kind of situations is actually very, very interesting in terms of othering, like the other team, in terms of any kind of intercultural concept. I think they are very relevant within, like, in our everyday life, within organizations where we try to work together.
Yeah, absolutely. And there, of course, you can also see how people talk this interculturality into being, like, despite those kind of objective categories that they apparently occupy that are kind of the same. I'm just thinking of a project I'm working on together with Lena Mikkola, and it's a data set collected by Lena, focus group discussions with members of interprofessional teams in healthcare context. And there's this one focus group that is actually conducted with four nurses. So we have four nurses who, well, they share their professional belonging, their organizational belonging. They all speak Finnish as their first language. They're all more or less the same age. And yet they bring in such interesting construct such interesting differences among them that are somehow, you know, located at intersections of professional membership and gender, for instance. It's a, you know, they discuss things like, you know, being a male nurse might be something different, or, you know, the way they construct this in their talk, the experience of being a male nurse as something different, and somehow positioning you differently than being a female nurse, for instance. So you find these things in places that maybe are unexpected if you have those kind of mainstream glasses on.
You sort of miss out on those if you focus on the big thing on national culture, which also does not really exist in a way. You do miss those small things that might actually even really matter to people, because this is what they're dealing with on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And
might have concrete consequences in their everyday working lives.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. So maybe this is something that our field should even focus more on. And
yeah, if somebody would want to broaden their horizons, so to speak, is there a specific text or book or somebody, like researcher or theorist, who has impacted your own thinking the most? So somebody who made you rethink your perspectives or lit a fire inside you?
I think in my case, I would have to say that it was my supervisor who supervised my dissertation, Liisa Tiitula, back then still in Tampere. And she was the person who influenced me the most in sort of rethinking my ideas about culture. But if you want to know some impressive kind of thick books or whatever, the first thing that comes to mind is Breidenbach and Neary. Mm-hmm. Their book, I think, Seeing Culture Everywhere, is very influential, at least on my thinking. I use this book quite a lot, also to sort of recalibrate myself, because I notice this in myself sometimes that I sort of yeah, I sometimes have these doubts maybe. and then this book sort of helps to recalibrate. I don't know how to name this better or how to say it better, but they have such a sharp analysis about how culture really is seen everywhere and is used as an explanation for things everywhere and in any kind of context. And I think it really has influenced me a lot.
Yeah, I'm thinking just of the whole range of different contexts that they look
at. Yeah, they
at,
cover a lot.
That in the business, yeah. Inter-ethnic conflict, the
yeah.
whole conflict is fueled by manipulating those ethnic, national, linguistic categories, for instance.
Yeah.
I think I would add, I think an article that really triggered something in me, some kind of critical reflection, was an old paper by Rona Haluwalani, Lily Mendoza and Jolanta Drzewiecka, and it was about redefining the discourse on identities in intercultural communication. That was somehow very approachable and made me think. But I would also, my all-time favorite would need to be Ingrid Pillé.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Her
yeah.
Intercultural Communication, A Critical Introduction.
Mm, that's also a
very
book that one can really,
yeah.
really recommend and
yeah.
has been also published again.
Yeah, yeah, there's a second edition. And I think the nice aspect of that book and of Pillar's view on intercultural communication, she's an applied linguist, is to also redefine the way we treat language in interaction. Moving away from this very essentialist way of seeing language as a national language, as a conduit for some national culture, and turning our attention towards language as a tool, as a resource in interaction, and how it allows for us to claim power, expertise, authority, or other, exclude people, for instance, make money, all these things. And perhaps also look into how people actually use language creatively. Like we were talking about culturing, and of course the same discussion is happening in applied linguistics and this talk of languaging.
Mm-hmm.
So language not as national languages pre-existing people, but rather language as people do it. In interaction,
which also kind of is liberating, isn't
yeah,
it? Because it finally lets us do language the way it makes sense in certain situations, and it does not impose on us so much anymore.
Yeah.
That there would be like one right way of speaking a language, but it actually gives us the freedom to use language in an innovative manner and to draw on it the way it makes sense for us or to us in a certain situation. I think this is also really important to keep in mind that language indeed is a tool and that we should have the freedom to use it in such a way that it makes sense to us instead of having it imposed on us and that there should be like a correct kind of grammar, for example, which is
and maybe even sensitize people that, you know, that they might be confusing someone's proficiency in some language with their expertise or intelligence
even. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and allowing everyone to claim ownership. I think this is what we've been telling our students in English taught classes, that remember that you can all claim English as your language.
This is also, I mean, it's very important for us
for
teachers,
everyone, yeah.
because obviously English is not our first language, and there might actually be like all sorts of feelings connected to using English in the classroom,
yeah.
and it kind of liberates me also as a teacher to know or to be able to open up on this and to invite students to do the same and to not to feel bad about the ways that we use the language.
And of course, these points need to be extended on to Finnish as well when we think of even ourselves as members
language.
of an organization.
Exactly.
But actually, to the list, I think we should still add Fred Derwin.
Absolutely. Yes.
Absolutely. Who has written so much on the maybe even paradigm shift, hopefully, in the field.
A lot which of is, no, yeah, it's still ongoing, obviously, but he has been writing about this, about intercultural communication and education, or interculturality in education, which has been very influential also.
Yeah. Maybe Adrian Holliday.
And Holliday.
Holliday. And I think maybe his concept, I think he's co-authoring this with Sara Amadasi, the notion of blocks and threads, which is something that we have kind of brought up several times in this in this discussion. But the idea of searching for connections with others in interaction
instead of those blocks, things that sort of separate
are from
us.
A different country and
you don't belong.
You celebrate Christmas differently.
Or not at all.
Or not at all.
Mm. I think we could continue this discussion forever. But before we end our chat, I'm giving you guys a magic wand.
Yes.
And now you have the magic wand. And with the swish of that wand, you can decide what would be something everybody would know after the swish of that wand about culture and communication. What is something you would kind of change with the swish of that magic wand?
Could we just erase culture? Everyday vocabulary.
Could that be a good idea to erase?
Erase.
Or would it be then just replaced by something else?
By that verb.
No, I mean that would it be then just replaced by something else?
Yeah, that's true. That, that's a very nice point, actually. People would find...
Probably they would find
their
something...
their way back to this.
But, well, maybe could it be something like the swish of the wand? Could it be something like that people would stop making assumptions about each other? Could it be something like that?
Yeah. Allow persons in interaction to present themselves they want to instead of imposing something on them.
Could it be about changing the way people are so worried about making a mistake, for example? Could it be about allowing people to embrace failure, like Durbin has been suggesting also, that it is okay to make mistakes maybe in interaction. It's okay to be stupid maybe even and or to say something stupid and to just embrace these kind of mistakes and learn from them. If we could with a magic wand sort of give people the power to accept that, mistakes belong to human social reality. That would be maybe cool. I don't know.
Yeah, I like this point a lot. And I think maybe it adds a nice touch to the discussion we've been having, because it might come across as if we're somehow painting a black and white reality that our way is the right way. And then there is this mainstream essentialist thinking. But I guess it's each and every one of us does this, and we do it, I guess, sometimes that we might bring in those kind of essentialist discourses about national culture, and it's okay. You don't have to.
Or we do ask, where are you from?
Yeah, we do ask.
Yeah, but I think it also applies to, thinking about intercultural competence trainings, which have been so much about telling people how to behave in a certain culture. I think it could also, appropriately, I think it could be also about this, that we give people a slack and allow them to not know.
Discover it.
Yeah, to discover whatever is there to be discovered and what might become relevant in interaction, and then to give people maybe the opportunity to do this together without any pre-conceptualizations or ideas that we have fed into them about this supposed other. Maybe it could be also about this, because what I think happens with those competence trainings oftentimes is that we imply that there is a right way of doing things, and don't ever greet a Chinese like this, for example, or don't ever do this in a certain situation. They will never forgive you. Maybe accepting failure, or with the ability to accept failure and mistakes, we could sort of move away from that also, that it's okay to go into any kind of situation, maybe unprepared, and to just to approach people as humans who most probably will also expect someone who doesn't speak Chinese, for example, to be somehow new to this locality and to be new to the language, or and that they would be able to adapt to that particular situation. Yeah. I think this could be something I would really love.
That. Yeah. Which kind of takes us back to this first point, doesn't it?
Mm.
To somehow treat persons as persons
in the first
right.
place,
and find those threads.
Mm. Mm.
What goes around comes around. It's a perfect spot to end our discussion. Thank you so much, Marke and Kriti. I truly hope your insights made somebody rethink their views and perspectives and assumptions regarding culture and communication. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
You just listened to Vuorotellen podcast by Prologos. We'll see you again next time when it's time for a whole nother topic.